Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We wanted to bring Anita Diamond to our campus and community for several years. And therefore, this event this evening, for me, is like a dream come true. I think all of you will agree with me that Anita Diamond is one of the most creative Jewish writers at work today. We are going to hear this evening about this new novel, Day After Night. I will not take any time from her presentation this evening by repeating all of the information about her publications, her career as a journalist, that you find in our program booklet. However, I do want to say something that isn't emphasized enough in that brochure, and that is, in addition to the acclaim that she has won for her novels, she has also written on several critical issues for contemporary Jews. I note that she was a finalist for the New Jews Brofman Big Ideas series at Brandeis University, where she proposed, following Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss's Minhag America, the American Jewish custom, that despite all of our differences, there is a vibrant and distinctive Jewish life that has emerged in America and has its own integrity and identity. Her other books on Jewish weddings, Raising Jewish Children, On Comforting the Dying, Burying the Dead, and Mourning as a Jew, Conversion to Judaism, The Naming of Children, and Living a Jewish Life, all have been important influences in the making of this Minhag America. She not only describes, but she also creates. For example, she is the co-founder of Mayim Chaim, Living Waters Community Mikveh, and Paula Brody and Family Education Center in Newton, Massachusetts. If you go to the website of Mayim Chaim, Living Waters, you'll see this extraordinary description of how the mikveh, the ritual bath of traditional Judaism in its history and its contemporary world, is being reinvented. Now, when she thought about this idea of the mikveh, she writes, "It was my dream to create a mikveh where time and space were available for converts and their families and friends, a space for marking all kinds of transitions, both joyful and sad, for brides and for mourners, for those celebrating a milestone, such as becoming a grandparent, and for those suffering losses." It's a great pleasure tonight to bring to our campus, for you, one of the great writers of our world today, extraordinary individual, helping to create this Minhag America. Please welcome Anita Diamond.
I'm here to talk about my new novel and explain to you a little bit about where it came from. Read a little bit from the early parts of the book. I hate readings that give away plot, so I promise not to. For those of you who haven't read it yet, I won't spoil anything for you. And then hopefully have an opportunity to do questions and answers and so that I can respond to questions that you might have come with this evening or that come up as a result of what I'm saying. One of the questions that I inevitably get is where do you get your ideas from? And writers actually joke with each other, and how do you answer that? From the idea store or from the idea tree? But alas, there is no such thing. My ideas kind of find me, and I'm of course always half looking for them. Years as a weekly columnist for a newspaper will do that for you. I wrote a weekly column for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine, and monthly columns for monthly magazines for a while. So the minute I finished one, there was another one staring me in the face. So I viewed my world as potential column fodder for many, many years. And my friends got nervous, actually, whenever I came towards them. But with a novel, it's not so different. I'm always sort of looking for ideas, or I'm open to them, but it has to be a bigger idea than a single, than a 500 or a 750 word essay. The idea has to be alive somehow. It has to be juicy. It has to be filled with characters and place as well. And it has to do that, because it has to sustain my interest as a writer for years. Also, my loathing and fear and my disinterest and my wish that I had never done this before. But still, it's like getting married, in other words, to an idea. For my husband's a great guy, really. But so the answer to the question, where do you get your ideas, is always different for me. But looking at the four novels that I have written so far, I know that there is one inspiration that sort of underlines all of them, which I just realized a few years ago. I was rushing to get on an airplane, and I realized I didn't have anything to read, and grabbed an old book from my college days, because it was short. It was a short flight. And I took it with me on the airplane, and I opened it, and I practically grabbed the woman sitting next to me and saying, "Oh my God, this is why I wrote The Red Tent." And that book is Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. And I know it was in my college undergraduate book, because it was a 75-cent paperback. That's how old it was. In A Room of One's Own, which is actually, I commend it to you again, it's a very funny book. It was delivered as a lecture to a women's college. In that short essay, Virginia Woolf challenged her readers to imagine the lives of women who had really been silent in history. She basically posited that women were invisible prior to the 18th century, that they certainly had not written their own lives, that we didn't really know anything about, for example, the women of Shakespeare, except for the characters that he had made. And The Red Tent was, in a way, an unconscious response to that clarion call that I heard as a 19-year-old undergraduate. The book, of course, grew out of many other sources as well, including my exposure to the tradition of Midrash, which is a Jewish literary form that depends upon the imagination to try to understand and make sense of Jewish scripture, of the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. There's this notion that there were untold stories hidden in the text. It's a traditional Jewish view of scripture. It was a doorway for me into retelling the story of Dinah in Genesis. And as you may know, Dinah doesn't have a single line. She doesn't say a word in Genesis. So I gave her about 300 pages of words, because I wrote the book in her voice. And I hope you can see that was in response, in a way, to Virginia Woolf's challenge for where are these women. My second novel, Good Harbor, I knew I was going to write a second novel, and I wanted it to be as different from my first one as humanly possible. But it grew out of a couple of things. One was, there was a period in my life where it felt to me like the phone was ringing every other week to tell me that another one of my friends was being diagnosed with breast cancer and was undergoing treatment. And at the same time, I had recently come under the spell of Cape Ann, which is about an hour north of Boston, where I live, and it's Gloucester and Rockport, which was the setting for this contemporary novel, which includes a story of women's friendships, which included one of the women being treated for breast cancer. My third novel, The Last Days of Dogtown, grew out of a pamphlet that I found in a bookstore. So I was trolling the bookstore in Gloucester, trying to find out as much as I could about this place that I had fallen in love with. And I found this little pamphlet called Dogtown, A Village Lost in Time, which had a bunch of maps in it which were worthless and got me good and lost. But they also included some thumbnail sketches of characters, the last characters who had lived in Dogtown, with these wonderful names like Easter Carter and Judy Rimes and Black Ruth, Cornelius and Oliver Younger. And coming up with names is one of the great challenges in writing a novel. So here they were on a platter for me with these little thumbnail sketches of eccentric characters. And I felt like I had been given a novel on a plate. This new novel, Day After Night, was hatched, I can tell you exactly when, in the spring of 2001, when my daughter was a high school student spending a semester in Israel. She was there as a high school student in a high school program and studying what all high school students, American high school students, study in English, English, She was taking French, math, science, and the history of Israel from prehistory to modern times. So my husband and I went on the parents' trip. It was our first time in Israel, and while we were there, we did what the kids were doing. We got on and off the bus, going on their field trips with them. And when we got there, we were at the point where they were studying the end of World War II and the creation of the State of Israel. So we visited battlefields, and we visited prisons. We visited the square in Tel Aviv when the announcement was made that the United Nations had recognized the State of Israel. And then we got off the bus at a place called Atlit. We were given a tour of what is kind of a living history museum. And I don't know what the equivalents are on the West Coast, but on the East Coast, it's sort of like going to Old Sturbridge Village or Plymouth Plantation or... is there something like that in California? Where it's a living history museum, people dress in costume. There's nothing old in California? Okay. Okay. Anyhow, you know what I'm talking about. Williamsburg, that sort of thing. Although in Israel, I got to tell you, it's not as fancy as all that. It's pretty basic. And so we walked through barbed wire fences into this internment camp where immigrants, quote unquote, illegal immigrants to Palestine had been kept by the British, who were running a blockade because there was a quota of the number of Jewish immigrants who were allowed. And we were given a remarkable tour and told the story of a rescue of the people who were in the camp on October 10th, 1945. And I remember sitting on the concrete floor in the relative cool, thinking, what a great novel that would make. And that was in 2001. But I was not in a rush to write this novel because I knew it was going to be a difficult novel to write because it would have to tell the story of Holocaust survivors coming to a new land and facing new challenges. And I was not in a rush to do that. In fact, I wrote a couple of other books in between. But this idea kept tapping me on my shoulder, and ultimately I turned and faced it and signed a contract and spent 3.5 years inventing the characters who will tell the story of Atlit and of the rescue from Atlit in Day After Night. I returned to Atlit to do research 2 other times as I worked on the book, and I got to know the physical landscape of the place better and better each time. Inside this large main building where immigrants had been processed, separated men from women, their clothes taken from them, sent to showers, terrifying the people who had seen that in Europe, in concentration camps. Inside this large building, which is enormous, it's like a hangar practically, there were photographs up on the walls of people who had been recent immigrants staring out through those barbed wire fences, just like the ones in not only in the concentration camps, but also in displaced persons camps right after World War II. And those photographs at least gave me the sense of standing in their shoes and seeing through their eyes in this beautiful, in this desolate, brutal, and dehumanizing place, suddenly recreated in Palestine. It must have been so painful for them to be standing on this longed-for land, on this destination, and be locked up at the same time. And looking at those pictures, I certainly felt the ache of that experience and also the outrage. And that, in a way, is where the book starts. And so I want to read you the prologue to Day After Night. It's short. Don't follow along. I think listening to the spoken word reminds us of the first time that we were exposed to the printed page, which is as children being read to and being sitting on a lap or sitting beside somebody. So this is the prologue to Day After Night. It begins 1945, August. The nightmares made their rounds hours ago. The tossing and whimpering are over. Even the insomniacs have settled down. The 20 restless bodies rest, and faces aged by hunger, grief, and doubt relax to reveal the beauty and the pity of their youth. Not one of the women in Barrack C is 21, but all of them are orphans. Their cheeks press against small military-issue pillows that smell of disinfectant. lumpy and flat from long service under heavier heads, they bear no resemblance to the goose down clouds that many of them enjoyed in childhood. And yet, the girls burrow into them with perfect contentment, embracing them like teddy bears. There were no pillows for them in the other barracks. No one gives a pillow to an animal. The British built Utleet in 1938 to house their own troops. It was one in a group of bases, garages, and storage units set up on the coastal plains a few miles south of Haifa. But at the end of the World War, as European Jews began making their way to the ancestral homeland in violation of international political agreements, the mandate in Palestine became messier, which is how it came to pass that Utleet was turned into a prison, or in the language of command, a detention center for refugees without permissory papers. The English arrested thousands as illegal immigrants, sent most of them to Utleet, but quickly set them free, like fish too small to fry. It was a perfectly forgettable compound of wooden barracks and buildings set out in rows on a scant square acre surrounded by weeds and potato fields. But the place offered a grim welcome to the exhausted remnant of the Final Solution, who could barely see past its barbed wire fences. Three of them, in fact, concentric lines that scrawled a crabbed and painful hieroglyphic across the sky. Not a half mile to the west of Utleet, the Mediterranean breaks against a rocky shore. When the surf is high, you can hear the stones hiss and sigh in the tidal wash. On the eastern horizon, the foothills of the Carmel reach heavenward, in keeping with their name, Kerem El, the vineyard of God. Sometimes the candles of a village are visible in the high distance, but not at this hour. The night is too old for that now. It is cool in the mountains, but hot and damp in Utleet. The overhead lights throb and buzz in the moist air, heavy as a blanket, and nothing moves. Even the sentries in the guard towers are snoring, lulled by the stillness and sapped, like their prisoners, by the cumulative weight of the heat. There are no politics in this waning hour of the night, no regret, no delay, no waiting. All of that will return with the sun, and the waiting is worse than the heat. Everyone who is locked up in Utleet waits for an answer to the same questions. When will I get out of here? When will the past be over? There are only 170 prisoners in Utleet tonight, and fewer than 70 women in all. It is the same lopsided ratio on the chaotic roads of Poland and Germany, France and Italy. The same in the train stations and the displaced persons camps, in queues for water, identification cards, shoes, and information. The same quotient, too, in the creaking, leaky boats that secretly ferry survivors into Palestine. There is no mystery to this arithmetic. According to Nazi calculation, males produced more value alive than dead, if only marginally, if only temporarily, so they killed the women faster. In Barrack C, the corrugated roof releases the last degrees of yesterday's sun, warming the blouses and skirts that hang like ghosts from the rafters. There are burlap sacks suspended there as well, lumpy with random rescued treasures, photograph albums and books, candlesticks, wooden bowls, broken toys, tablecloths, precious debris. The narrow cots are lined up unevenly against the naked wood walls, and the floor is littered with thin wool blankets kicked aside in the heat. A baby crib stands empty in the corner. In Haifa, the lights are burning in the bakeries where the bread rises and the workers pour coffee and light cigarettes. On the kibbutz among the pine trees high in the Carmel, the dairymen are rubbing their eyes and pulling on their boots. In Utleet, the women sleep. Nothing disturbs them. No one notices the soft stirring of a breeze, the blessing of the last and gentlest chapter of the day. It would be a kindness to prolong this peace and let them rest a bit longer, but the darkness is already heavy with the gathering light. The birds have no choice but to announce the dawn, and eyes begin to open. So that's where we begin, in the physical landscape. Oh, thank you. So that's that's where we begin in the physical landscape of this place. And place is very central in this book. That particular place, those particular barracks, those fences, there's still a barrack that's set up that sort of recreates what it looked like at the time. But more than the physical landscape, I was drawn to the historical and the emotional landscape of the time. It's 1945, and the war is just over. For Americans, I think we think of that time as that iconic photograph of the sailor kissing the nurse in Times Square, which is a picture of enormous joy and release. But the rejoicing was not so giddy for everybody in the world, and certainly not for the characters in my book or for the people who found themselves stuck in Atlit. Even after this triumph of reaching Palestine, an unlikely triumph, a place that many believed in the most primal way to be their home, they found themselves confronted with another trial, another stumbling block. But it was a mixed kind of message, because within the barbed wire enclosure, they found Jews from Palestine reassuring them, "Don't worry, you're safe, this is temporary, we're going to help you." And they were being told this, these survivors, by Jews with sunburns and muscles speaking in Hebrew. Who were they supposed to believe? How could they hope? So Day After Night explores this dual reality of being imprisoned and home at the same time, of being subjected to these early morning roll calls, and then in the afternoon being offered Hebrew language classes, of sleeping on planks in crude barracks, but having more than enough food to eat. That was this weird conundrum facing the inmates at Atlit, and specifically my four girls, my main characters, whose names are Teddy, Zora, Shandel, and Leonie. And they are girls, little more than teenagers who have suffered more in their short lives than most grandparents ever know. And at its heart, I think Day After Night explores the question of how people manage unspeakable memories and yet move into the future at the same time. How do orphans, these are all orphans, cut off from everything they know, from family, from friends, from the language and the landscape and even the culture, the food that they know, cope with a new climate, a new culture, a new language, people who don't speak their own language, expectations for a whole new life? So I think of Day After Night as a book about resilience. But again, we tend as Americans, I think, to think of resilience as kind of cheerful and happy. But resilience in this setting includes a kind of bitter, tough resilience as well as a gentle and happy resilience. Taking on these multiple landscapes is part of, I think, all fiction writing. But there's a special kind of challenge to it when you're writing historical fiction, when I'm writing into the past. Because describing Atlit as it was for refugees of the Holocaust in 1945, even having visited there three times and doing research, was a huge leap of imagination, because I'm describing their experience not from the perspective of an omniscient narrator, but through the eyes of these particular characters. And that's a great act of chutzpah, to use the great Yiddish word. Which is something that, believe it or not, Henry James was familiar with. In 1901, Henry James wrote a letter to a novelist whose name was Sarah Orne Jewett, who had just published a historical novel. She was actually a very popular novelist at the time, and this was something called The Tory Lover. So he writes this letter to a novelist who's much younger and less famous than him. And this is what he wrote to her. Quote, "The historic novel is condemned to a fatal cheapness for the simple reason that the difficulty of the job is inordinate." I feel so bad for Sarah Orne Jewett to get this letter. James wrote, quote, "You may multiply the little facts that can be gotten from pictures and documents, from relics and prints, as much as you like. The real thing is almost impossible to do. I mean the invention, the representation of the old consciousness, the soul, the horizon, the vision of the individuals. You have to think up with your modern apparatus, a man, a woman, or rather 50, whose own thinking was intensely otherwise conditioned. You have to simplify back by an amazing tour de force, and even then, it's all humbug." I actually think Henry James has a point. I think the modern apparatus, We're really not even aware of how the modern apparatus functions as blinders and makes us think that the way we understand the world is the way that people in the past understood the world. It is hard to see past the horizons of our own assumptions, our language, everything we take for granted. When I wrote The Red Tent, I was certainly, in some ways, risking being an enormous humbug because I was reaching back thousands of years. How could I, as a contemporary person living in the 20th century, imagine a world without everything, without clocks and calendars, without literacy, without antibiotics, without caffeine? It's really tough to think that far back. In Day After Night, you might think it would be a little easier. It's really not so far. I was born in the 20th century. I was actually born in 1951. You can do the math. This is set in 1945. And yet the experience of my protagonists, these Holocaust survivors, is equally unthinkable. My modern apparatus, in a way, as much as we read, as much as we see movies, as much as we see documentaries, you run up against the impossibility of imagining back. To place myself inside that terror and to presume to speak for it, this is an enormous act of chutzpah, which probably explains why it took me a long time to decide that I was going to try and risk it and write this book. But I did write Day After Night because all of those landscapes, the geographical, the historical, and the emotional, were just too compelling for me not to risk the attempt at setting aside my modern apparatus, at trying to explore what was different in the way I understand the world from the way that these young girls would have understood the world a generation before me, from inside that consciousness, the souls of my four fictional protagonists. And, of course, I'm not in complete agreement with Henry James on the subject of historical fiction, even though I couldn't completely jettison my modern intellectual and cultural apparatus while writing The Red Tent. Some things don't change. The body is still the body. The human body is still the human body, which is also an ancient apparatus. We all grow and come of age. We enjoy food. We discover sex. We endure childbirth and aging and death. And all that pleasure and pain is not specific to any particular time or place, which makes it possible to take the risk into writing historical fiction and to imagine the world of 1945, when I learned through my research, survivors were really discouraged from talking about what they had lived through. When victims of horrible violence were expected, they were expected to put all the pain behind them and focus only on the work at hand and the dream of the future. This was a world awash in secrets and in guilt. There was the guilt of those who had survived. Why me? Why not my brother, my sister, my sainted mother? But also the guilt of those who hadn't suffered as much, who had survived without enduring concentration camps, and the guilt of those who were ashamed that they had not known more or done more to stop the slaughter. So in Day After Night, I tried to burrow into all of those silences a little, and I do believe that I can reach beyond my own historical and geographical and cultural horizon because all human beings do experience suffering and recovery and loss and resilience in some form or other. And I think that's the reason we have the arts, is to transcend, to provide us with ways to transcend time and to transport us, however provisionally or briefly, to really unfamiliar landscapes where we can see and understand the world and history and the soul in different ways. And I think that's why storytelling is so important. Because when you finish reading a story that opens your heart up to a new insight about what it means to be human, I think the universe tips, however slightly, in the direction of compassion and maybe even in the direction of peace. So I chose to tell this story from the perspective of four different characters, as I mentioned before, Teddy, Zora, Shandel, and Leonie. And I want to introduce you to them briefly, just by reading the introductory paragraphs, so you get to meet these four girls. They are fictional characters. They are not based on individuals that I read about or interviewed or met. They are pieced together. I think their stories are probable, and I hope they feel real. And here they are. Teddy is the first. You have to remember how very young they are. Teddy woke to the smell of brine. It reached her from beyond the dunes and past the latrines, confounding the stale breath and sour bodies of the other 19 girls in her barrack. She sat up on her cot, inhaled the sharp salt fragrance, and smiled. Teddy Pastori had lost her sense of smell during the war. With too little to eat, she had lost her period, too. Her heavy blonde hair had grown dull, her fingernails brittle and broken. But everything was coming back to her in Palestine. In the 2 weeks since she'd been in Atlit, Teddy's nose had become as keen as a dog's. She could identify people with her eyes closed, not only who they were, but also what they'd been up to, and sometimes even what they were feeling. She caught the overwhelming scent of sex on a girl she passed in the compound and gagged on the strange choking tang of burning hair that rose from Zora White's, who slept on the far side of her barrack, an angry little Pole with flashing brown eyes and a crooked front tooth. At first, Teddy thought she was going crazy, but once she realized that no one suspected her secret, she stopped worrying about it and fixed her attention on the future. Her plan was to live on a kibbutz where everyone smelled of oranges and milk, and to forget everything that had come before. For Teddy, memory was the enemy of happiness. She had already forgotten the name of the ship that had brought her to Palestine, and of the stocky Greek boy who had held her shoulders while she retched, seasick, into a bucket. She wondered if she could fill her head with enough Hebrew to crowd out her native Dutch. Teddy promised herself that the moment she walked away from Atlit, she would forget everything about it as well. The ugly, parched dirt compound, the long days, the heat, and the girls from all over Europe, the nice ones as well as the obnoxious ones. She would forget the cool blue mirage of mountains in the distance, too, and the eccentric volunteers from the Yeshuv, which is what they called the Jewish settlement here. She would start all over, like a baby, and she toyed with the idea of putting a new name, a Hebrew name, on her next identity card. She would become like the pioneer boys and girls, the ones who had grown up in Poland and Romania, singing about the land of Israel and dreaming of a life filled with farm work and folk dancing. Sons and daughters of shopkeepers and teachers, their Zionist summer camp had given them a taste for physical labor. All they talked about was how they wanted to plow and dig and fight and build a state. They seemed to face the future without a single backward glance. She thought they were wonderful. The Zionist kids liked her too, although she knew it was mostly because of her blonde hair and her height. They could be arrogant and rude. One boy called Teddy a fine specimen to her face. And while she knew they said such things without malice, she was self-conscious among them. In Amsterdam, she had been one of many Jewish girls with blue eyes, narrow hips, and broad shoulders. Like her, most of Teddy's friends had had at least one Lutheran parent or grandparent, and it was considered bad taste to take note of anyone's mixed parentage until 1940, when non-Jewish relatives became assets. Teddy yawned and stretched. She was the barrack's champion sleeper, out like a light as soon as her head touched the pillow, and so slow to wake up that she sometimes missed breakfast. When she finally put her feet on the cool cement floor, she realized that she was alone and quickly pulled on her dress. On her way out, Teddy noticed Zora curled in a tight ball on her cot near the door, which Teddy closed as quietly as she could. Then she ran toward the latrine, telling herself not to worry. There really was no danger of going hungry in Atlit. Even when the kitchen ran out of tea or sugar, there was always plenty of bread and cucumbers and that tomato salad the locals seemed to think was a fit dish for breakfast. Sitting on the toilet, she tried to remember the word for tomato. Agvania, she said. What? Came a voice from behind the partition. I didn't know anyone was here, said Teddy. If you want agvania, you'd better hurry and get to the mess. They're going to close the door. So that's Teddy, our first girl. And Teddy already mentioned Zora, the second. All four of these girls are in the same barrack, in Barrack C, which is how they get to know one another over the course of the novel, which starts in August of 1945 and concludes really in October of 45. So now I'd like to introduce you to Zora. Also, morning scenes. These are all morning scenes. It was so quiet in the barrack, Zora could hear the soldier clear his throat and the wind in the cypress tree outside. That was a sound she supposed that others might find beautiful and soothing. But to her, it was just more proof that the workings of the world were random, that beauty, like suffering, was meaningless, that human life was as pointless as waves on sand. Zora hated the sea as much as she hated the wind in the trees. She hated Teddy on the far side of the room for the ease with which she fell asleep. But most of all, she hated the way people kept thanking God, even now, even here, where they were imprisoned for breaking rules made in a distant, irrelevant past, in the time before words like boxcar and lampshade could chill you to the bone. So many words had become unmoored from their old meanings. The English called them illegal immigrants, but Zora recognized the term for what it was, a polite version of filthy Yid. What other explanation could there be for a place like Atlit? She squeezed her eyes shut and dared God to stop her from hating everything in his creation, including this Palestine, this promised, this holy land. In April, when Zora had heard the news that Hitler was dead, the Hebrew blessing had nearly slipped out of her mouth, but she fought the reflex and bit her tongue hard enough to draw blood. She would never again say, "God be praised." Her mother and father would have said it. Her grandmothers and grandfathers, her aunts, uncles, and cousins would have said it, along with the professional beggars who had worked her street in the poorest of Warsaw's Jewish neighborhood. Zora cursed everyone in Atlit who said those words, especially the men who prayed morning and evening, wrapped in their dirty prayer shawls. How dare they? That's Zora. The last two girls, Shandel and Leonie, actually know each other a little bit before they get to Atlit. They meet on the way there. So I'm going to introduce them to you together again in an early morning moment in the barrack. Shandel begins whispering, "I think Zora may have a crush on the guard with the thick glasses," she said as she whispered into Leonie's cot. No one else in the barrack was awake yet, which meant it was their time to talk. "In the last week, she's asked me 3 times if I've seen him, and at last night at the party, she kept looking around as if she was waiting for someone." "I can't imagine what your toes must feel like," Shandel went on. "I saw you dancing with that oaf Otto. I don't think he's good enough for you, Cherie. I don't mind hairy men so much, but given the lack of girls around here, even I could probably do better." "Don't talk about yourself like that," said Leonie, as she pushed a wisp of wiry hair behind her friend's ear. "Lots of boys wanted to dance with you." The celebration had taken place in honor of the most improbable and romantic coincidence imaginable. A girl from a new group of detainees had recognized her childhood sweetheart through the fence, and when they opened the gate, the two of them fell into each other's arms. Everyone was shouting and clapping, and even the English soldiers had tears in their eyes. Colonel Bryce, the camp commander, had given permission for a party. The cook had attempted a cake, a bottle of schnapps had appeared. One of the newcomers had a violin, and the dancing went on until midnight. "They snuck the boyfriend into the girls' barrack," Shandel said. "I'll bet nobody slept the whole night over there. Even if they hung up blankets around them, everyone must have been listening. Though it would have been worse in the boys' barrack, don't you think?" she continued, dropping her voice even lower. "You know what they would have been doing, don't you?" Leonie wrinkled her nose, which was Roman in profile and in perfect proportion to the rest of her features. Shandel often thought the only reason that the great beauty of Atlit tolerated her attentions was the fact that she spoke a little French. Standing next to Leonie, Shandel felt like a real Polish peasant, with her coarse reddish mop of hair, her skinny legs, and a body shaped like a potato. "Are you a prude?" Shandel teased, hoping she had gotten the idiom right. "I'm still set on finding us a couple of brothers when we get out of here, you know. Brothers who want to live close by each other. Nice, steady types. We live on a kibbutz, but on Sunday afternoon we can go to Tel Aviv, where there are shops and cafes and we can sit over our coffee cups and watch the crowds pass by." Leonie said nothing but squeezed Shandel's hand, a signal for her to continue with the story she had recited every day, like morning prayers, since they'd gotten on the boat to Palestine. "We'll eat ice cream, we'll go shopping. You will teach me how to dress, and I will show you how to make the best stuffed cabbage in the world. It'll be a good life for us. I'll find us the two brothers. We'll each have 2 children. "Like Noah's Ark," said Leonie on cue. "Exactly. Like once upon a time," Leonie sighed. Nearly everything about Palestine felt like make-believe to her. The bottomless baskets of soft bread and the bland white cheese seemed like food for angels or babies. Atlit itself felt like a fairy tale dungeon, the prisoners waiting for someone to end the evil spell and release them to live in the happy land of the kibbutz. And Hebrew was the most fantastic thing of all to her, a dead language walking around in the world, a holy tongue with slang for bullet and penis, and the magical power to invent or change whatever it needed. Abracadabra. So those are the four of them. And the four of them, and the reason I chose four was to talk about the diversity of responses to tragedy and how people move into the future. I am the child of survivors. They weren't camp survivors, but they survived the war in Europe. And my father was an optimist, and my mother was a pessimist. And both of those strategies served them well in very different ways to cope with what they'd gone through and to face life in America, not in Palestine, in their own ways. Anyway, I want to just finish my remarks by talking to you a little bit about the cover of this book, which I think is spectacular. It's a photograph. The art director at Scribner, whose name is Rex Bonomelli, was determined that this should be a photograph, it should be archival, and sent me and the editors also photograph after photograph after photograph of four girls. He was looking specifically for a picture of four girls to match these four characters in my book, and they were all wrong. They were either wearing the wrong clothes or they were standing in the wrong place, and then when we got one that was okay, none of them was blonde, and Teddy's a blonde, so should we Photoshop that? It was too literal. It didn't work. And then finally I got an email that said, I think we found it. And he was right, because this image is so powerful and so evocative. Though it's not four girls, it's not these four girls. You might guess that it was shot in Palestine or Israel, but it wasn't. It's got great story attached to it, this photograph. This picture was taken in Germany in 1935 at a youth Aliyah camp, at a camp where young Jewish kids went to sort of practice what it would be like to live in Palestine on a kibbutz. And the picture came from the archive of a famous photographer named Herbert Sonnenfeld, who was born in Berlin, and he and his wife Leni chronicled Jewish life in Germany as long as they could until they left in 1939. They tried to emigrate to Palestine, but the British mandate, the quota was full, and they were not permitted to move there. So they came to the United States, and they spent the war years here and in other diaspora communities. They went to Israel as soon as they possibly could and took some of the great iconic pictures of the early state of Israel with boys in caps and bulging muscles and people dancing the hora. But this is a picture from 1935. And it's a picture of great joy, of young girls, and I think maybe one boy. There's a big debate about whether this is a boy or a girl, dancing in their shorts. And the question is, did they make it? Did they make it to Palestine? Did they make it to Israel? Did any of them? Did all of them? We have no way of knowing. But the image remains with us, and the image remains full of energy and hope and youth, because somehow we are still here. Somehow we are in Israel as well. And somehow day did follow night. So with that, I want to stop talking and welcome your questions. So thank you.
Did you find yourself kind of haunted by the characters, by the locale, by the stories of these four women?
Haunted is one way to put it. When I'm writing a novel, I live with these characters in a kind of way. And again, I keep thinking of this image of being tapped on the shoulder. I don't always. There's an enormous amount of procrastination that goes into writing a novel, at least for me and the people that I know. So every now and then there would be this sort of push to move forward. And I'm also in a writing group, so my partners pushed me forward. But I found this very difficult to write because there's a lot of pain in their stories. And by the same token, I'm not somebody who likes to read books with no resolution, with no redemption at the end. So there has to be some turn. There has to be some possibility of healing and change and growth. So it was a challenge to be honest to the pain at the same time to write something that I would want to read that includes, along with the pain, the possibility of healing, along with night, day. So that they were very much with me. And people often ask if I miss them when I'm done. But by the time I'm done, I'm tired of them.
Thanks. How did you go about that process to come up with these very definitive characters? Because they really carry the book.
Yeah. Thank you. That's such a good question. I'm so confused about how to answer that. Because I sort of discover characters as I write them on the page. Teddy, who's the Dutch girl who starts the book, with her, I found her name first. Naming, as I said before, is really tough. And her name, Teddy and Pastore, also came to me. I don't know. I liked the sound of it. And I had read about, and I actually had, I think part of that comes from having met somebody who many years ago was a man who's Dutch, and who said, he's not Jewish, many years after the war, that on his block in Amsterdam, there were a lot of people who hid Jews, and it just wasn't talked about, and he had sort of had to push people in his family to talk about what had happened. So, of course, Anne Frank is the great iconic story, and there's a new book about that whole experience this year. So I wanted to learn more about the Dutch experience. So I read about Dutch Jews, and there's actually a book this thick about the experience of Dutch Jews. So that's where that one came from. Schindel is based loosely on sort of partisans. On stories and documentary material about partisans, but there's not a lot written about the girls who were in the woods with the boys, who were really fighting. And so I wanted to imagine what that experience would have been like. Leonie is French, and it's the one language. It's my second language, so I wanted to do something with the French. And Zora is a survivor of Auschwitz. She's the Holocaust camp survivor, typically. So they're four very different points of view. And they're very female and feminine stories of loss and betrayal and the body. So I wanted to talk about the multiplicity of those experiences. And I got to know them more and more as I wrote and revised as well. And they changed, the names changed along the way as well, except for Teddy. That one from the beginning. I don't know why. It's a mystery.
I wondered if you could comment whether this came up for your characters or whether it was something that you found in your research, is that I'm just wondering about the parallels between their experience and the birth of Zionism and a lot of the feelings that went along with being in Israel at that time. And one thing that I found, and I'm trying to figure out how to formulate these, there's a lot of feelings about this for me, but when I visited my relatives as a very young child, there was an anger. You know, they wouldn't speak English to me. They wouldn't write in English to me, even when my Hebrew wasn't great. Later on, when I lived there, my Hebrew was much better. It was fine. Now when they write me in their old age, you know, they've mellowed a little bit, mm-hmm. and they'll throw in a few English words. But it was like a fierce kind of anger and fierce kind of Zionistic feeling. And I'm just wondering if you came upon that and if you could comment on whether or not there is a relationship between the experience they went through and connected to that, why they chose to go to Israel versus going to other places. And it's a convoluted question, but I've been sort of haunted by this relationship with them and wondering about their experience and what went into that paralleled with the birth of the state and those fierce feelings of, you know.
Right.
Anyway.
But it's complicated. I mean, the founding of the State of Israel was the end of the war, and the testimony of people coming over from Europe and the secrets and the guilt and it's one of the more upsetting pieces of research that I read was about for people who were living already in Palestine, who were part of the Jewish community, the Yishuv. There was also anger at the survivors. I think it exposed their own weakness. It was a very complicated psychological mess. So there was anger. There was anger from survivors. Why didn't you do more for us? There was anger from the people in the Yeshuv about them, you know, as And that, you know, the language of the sheep, which everybody, the sheep to slaughter, which everybody is repudiating now, there was anger that, you know, why didn't you fight stronger? And there's actually an exchange in the book, you know, that you think that we, you know, you have no idea what we went through. How dare you look at us that way? So there's this, all that, and most of this is unspoken. And that makes it more impacted and unhealthy in some ways. And one of the things I learned in Tom Segev's book, The 6 Million, was important for my research, was that really people started talking openly only after the Eichmann trials in 1961, and it sort of like ripped the scab off, and people, which isn't to say that people weren't writing memoirs and weren't doing it, but it was not a public conversation. There was just a huge amount of silence and pain. So I think that feeds anger as well. Not everybody. I mean, some people temperamentally and for all sorts of other reasons were able to move forward without that. But, when you're talking about this collective trauma, I don't see how it doesn't not have a huge impact on people in anger and bitterness as well as hope and joy. So convoluted answer. Complicated question. We'll be writing books and making movies about this for generations, I'm sure.
My name is Ilan Levy.
Hello.
I was born in Israel.
I figured.
To a father who spent a year in Atlit.
After the war?
He arrived in Palestine in 1940.
Oh.
And I think he left, he didn't have much choice about where to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And he ended up in Atlit for about a year and got out in 1942. I'm very interested in that time of his life, which he never spoke much about, and probably for the many reasons you state. But is there any source of information that you've come across in your research that can maybe give me some more details about that portion of his life?
I actually met a woman in Miami who had been in Atlit early, too, like in 1942. And she was there for a long time as well. So it was used as an internment camp for years and years. And it is remarkable how little documentation there is of that period and of this period as well. And so the historians at Atlit are trying to collect as much as possible. But what I was able to read are very short little, like a paragraph or two paragraphs long of memories that people seemed willing or able to come out with. So I think there's, you know, we think that modern history is so well documented, but in fact there are these big gaps. So actually the next time, you should look at the website for Atlit and be in touch with them and see if they have material from, my interest was very narrowly focused on 1945, but I do know that, and people actually stayed in the camp for very relatively short periods because there was such pressure on it. But I've learned that that people were kept for long periods of time and it was miserable. The woman I met in Miami, it was a miserable experience, and she was hungry, and it was hot, and it was just waiting. It was a prison. It was a prison. Actually, after the state was found in 1948, the Israelis used it as an absorption camp, and it was miserable then too, and it was very crowded, and there were tents as well as barracks. So, it was a place of misery for a very long time. It was almost knocked down completely. I think it was in the 80s, and somebody said, no, this is a historic site and we should save it. It was about to be turned into basically a parking lot or a warehouse, something like that, but they saved it. So you can look on the site and read, they have an English and Hebrew, and so I would encourage you to be in touch with them and see if they have material from earlier on.
I did visit the camp.
Oh, you did?
Twice. And they were soliciting personal stories, and so I filled out the form as best I could.
And did they have anything in the database?
No.
Really. How long ago were you there?
I was there several times, but the first time was in 1983.
Oh, in 83. That was early. So they have more now, but still, it's remarkable how little testimonies there are. But that's the repository.
Thank you.
So which is why I made up as much as I did.
I really appreciate historical novels for their powerful ability to transport and inform people of other times and places that they may not be exposed to. But I wonder how you resolve that with the other prime directive for writers is to write what they know.
Well, I know about the humor, I know about everybody, it's the great cliche, but if that was absolutely the case, then you wouldn't write, nobody would write historical fiction, because how do we really know? I mean, you can do as much research, this is Henry James's, as Henry James said, write what you know. You can't do that. You're doomed to, you know, to this sort of fallacy, some sort of, you know, that your modern understanding of things is going to wreck what you write. It's dishonest. But I don't agree with that completely. And it's a risk. And some people who write what they know write badly, too. So, I mean, it's like writing about what you know doesn't mean that you have insight into what you know. So
you just put that aside then? You just put all that aside and just go for it?
Yeah, if you're going to write historical fiction, absolutely. Or if you're going to write about anybody who's not exactly like you. I mean, how narrowly are you going to define that, too? Does that mean men can't write about women and women can't write about men? Does that mean I can't have characters in my book who are freed African slaves, as they are in one of my books? I mean, does that mean I'm limited? I can only write about Jewish women who were born in 1951 and have one child? And, you know, how narrow do we get here?
It's a very confining cliche.
It is,
but you hear it in your head.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. How dare you? There is that kind of how dare you. But that, I think that's true whenever you sit down to write. For me, it's like someone else is going to do it better, has done it better, but you just ignore it.
What is your daily work schedule like, and how do you work as a writer?
It's so boring. Once I'm really on a project, I'm worrying about it all the time, thinking about it all the time, and the work includes doing research, and I tend to do research and writing simultaneously. Although I'll do some research to start, to have a sense of where I'm starting from, and then the research and the writing feed each other. As I write something, I realize I'll need to know something that I didn't realize I needed to know, like for example, the food. What were they eating at Atlee? What were they being served? What weren't they being served? And I didn't want to make mistakes like that. So I'll do the research on that as I'm writing a food scene. So the writing and the research feed each other. They go back and forth. I give myself deadlines. You know, I want to be this far by the end of the summer. Being a journalist is very helpful in that I actually make my deadlines. My publishers love me. A lot of novelists don't make their deadlines. But that was beaten into me for 20 years of being a journalist, which I find really helpful. And I revise endlessly, constantly, till the very end. And whenever I read anything, I think, oh, I would not write that word. I would use a different word. I'm also very lucky. I have a writing group, which is there are three of us. And it's changed over the years. But right now, it's Steve McCauley and Amy Hoffman and me. And we meet every 6 weeks or so and exchange drafts and give each other feedback and also provide the kind of support that you need when you work by yourself all the time. So we're cheerleaders as much as we are editors for each other. It's really been important for me. So that's a little bit of how. And as I'm approaching the end of getting closer and closer to the deadline, I get very serious and I work long hours. I tend to write in the mornings after a lot of coffee and walking the dog. And now I'm in between, and this is the longest actually I've been between deadlines, and I look forward actually to going home and getting started on something new next month. So.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.